Two things you can count on in any summer in our region. One, fire. Two, smoke. Make that three things. Fire, smoke, and a debate about how to keep both the fires and the smoke down in future fire seasons. Our next guest watches the debate with interest. He spent many years in forest and fire management, so has extensive perspective on both. Richard Fairbanks lives in the Applegate Valley now. He worked many different positions in the U.S. Forest Service, including a stint as the team leader for the Biscuit Fire Recovery Project. The Biscuit burned 500,000 acres in 2002, one of Oregon's largest fires ever. He joins us by phone from the Applegate. Richard, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning.
Give us a quick sketch beyond what we just talked about and the kinds of things that you did over the years in the Forest Service.
Well, I was a squad leader on an interagency hotshot crew, and then I was foreman on another interagency hotshot crew. I also did, for a number of years, I was foreman of a brush disposal crew, control burn crew, basically. We used to do a lot more controlled burning in the Northwest. It's kind of not as common as it used to be. And I also did some planning work. Did fire plans for a couple of national forests. I did wind up on the team leader slot for the Biscuit, what they call the Biscuit Fire Recovery Project. So got involved in that.
I noticed, too, that you've been called as an expert witness on fire. I'm curious about the situations in which that's happened.
Well, yeah, I have worked cases in Oregon, California, Utah, Arizona, and Idaho. Don't forget Idaho. As an expert witness, yes.
And because of the fact that you spent that much time on fires and know, it sounds like, not only what happens when the fire is going on, but the conditions that lead to the fire doing what a fire does.
Yes, and they like that. When I was a grad student, some of my coursework, quite a bit of my coursework, was in fire behavior and fire ecology and stuff. So the courts, I think they like that, a little bit of academic background too.
So fire behavior and fire ecology is a really, I'm avoiding using the term hot issue, but I guess that's where we go.
All right.
The fact is, we're talking about a year where we had the fire NATO come into Redding with the car fire, and the original estimate was around 135 mile an hour winds in this fire whirl. Fire whirls are known, but generally not that fast. And then as of last week, they even boosted the readings up to about 160 miles an hour. Are we seeing fire behaviors that you just didn't think were possible a few years ago?
Yes, we're seeing things that nobody'd ever heard of or really proven. There was some anecdotal evidence that there was some sort of fire tornado going on in a couple of the big fires. The Idaho 1910 fire was famous for that. They found uprooted trees and so forth. But I have the video taken from the helicopter. You know, now we have real empirical proof that there are fire tornadoes that are. When I was a kid, every once in a while we'd see one that was maybe 6-8 feet tall, but to have one that's a quarter mile wide is pretty impressive.
And what do you think is the major contributing factor? I mean, why are we seeing this now when we didn't before?
Well, that particular one was burning a couple of subdivisions, so it had 8,000-10,000 board feet of kiln dried lumber in each house to fuel it. And that's sort of the new fuel model that has appeared in the last few decades, is that wildland-urban interface fuel. And it is pretty volatile, obviously, if you've been watching the video.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of crazy to see it, but that's exactly what happened. So Richard Fairbanks, the constant refrain from many sides of the political spectrum when we begin to talk about fires in terms of what we do for the future to reduce things like what's been happening this year, the constant refrain from many sides is that the forests are overstocked. There's too much fire fuel in them. First, do you agree? And if you do, why are they overstocked?
Well, we live in an ecosystem where the warm season is at the same time as the dry season. So if we were in a beech forest back east, it would rain in the summer and the fungi and insects and stuff would be able to break down fuel pretty rapidly. If we were in Costa Rica, where it rains every day, and on the west side of Costa Rica there, you would find things rotted incredibly fast. You would just not get a buildup of fuel. But if you got a place where the dry season prevents the fungi and insects from decomposing things as fast as they might, you get a buildup of fuels, and fire evolved, it is thought, to take care of that buildup, to rebalance that, recycle those materials back into the forest soil. And we kind of interrupted that. In 1911, they passed the Weeks Act in response to some of the big fires they had back then. And we, as a country, decided we were going to fight wildfires.
Just going to put them out. I mean, just try to put them out.
Right. Just going to put them out because, you know, in Europe, you were able to do that. And back east, you were able to do that because fire wasn't really part of the, you know, integral part of the ecosystem. And we just didn't realize in the West that that isn't working.
So this sounds like a situation where you've got people making decisions who aren't familiar with what the conditions are like on the ground in the area that they're making decisions about.
Well, yeah, I would say that one of the key problems is that we need to let our elected officials know about the science and about how much this is bothering people. I don't think most congressmen realize that, you know, they've got constituents in, you know, two or three states now that have been sitting in the smoke for a month solid. And we did it last year, and I'm a little tired of it, and I've got, you know, a lot of background in this stuff, and, you know, I'm just fed up with the politicians just saying it's inevitable, there's nothing we can do about it. It's not inevitable, and there's plenty we can do about it. Sorry if I got a little excited there, but our elected officials really need to get off their, well, anyway.
Okay. Well, we'll just leave that area blank. Richard Fairbanks is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a fire expert with extensive service, years of service, decades of service for the U.S. Forest Service. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Your questions, comments, welcome at 800-838-3760. By phone, by email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. You said there are things we can be doing. You're tired of the smoke. So if you get to be, I don't know, member of Congress and Forest Service boss all in the same day, what would be the first thing you'd do?
Well, I'd start doing a lot more control burning in the spring and the fall when we don't have inversions. Right now, we have stable air. And smoke can't rise. And just waiting around for lightning to decide that now is a good time to have a wildfire is a recipe for having a lot of smoke, because in the summer we get these inversions. So burn the same acres in blocks, control burn, in the fall and spring when we've got a lot of unstable air days, when smoke goes straight up and doesn't ever get into human lungs, is one of the key things I think we ought to do. And I do think we ought to do a lot more of fuel treatment. And I think we ought to do it strategically. We've got some really solid science that says burning, between 10 and 15% of a landscape, if you burn along certain strategic roads and ridges and, you know, so forth, you can make it so that when fires occur, you're going to have a lot better chance of controlling them because you've already burned certain areas and sort of fireproofed them. And we are seeing that with several of our large burns now have burned into an old five-year-old fire or three-year-old fire, whatever, and they go out. So that's one of the things that's going on now is we're having a lot of these large fires are hitting another burn and going out. But what I'm talking about is, in addition to that, having a lot of controlled burning. Primarily what I mean is underburning, where you basically, when conditions are relatively mild and wet, and again, unstable, you light the understory on fire, and you burn up the needles and twigs and the brush and so forth without killing the trees. We are fortunate that around here we're mixed conifer. We have a lot of fire-resistant species, individual trees that through thick bark and real robust wound response and so forth, they just don't mind an occasional low-severity fire. So we've got a forest that can survive fires if we'll just keep underburning so we don't get this huge buildup of fuels. The tribes figured this out a few thousand years ago. It's time for us to maybe sort of relearn that message.
In fact, we'll be talking to the Karuk tribe next week about their experiment going on in the Klamath River basin, scheduled, we hope, for when fire season ends, which we hope will be sometime this fall. You mentioned, though, there's less controlled burning. Why is there less controlled burning?
Well, a lot of the controlled burning we did in the 70s and 80s was based on having a lot of money from clear-cut timber harvest of old-growth trees. That's not coming back, that source of income. We used to have a lot of money for maintaining roads, for burning, for planting, and so forth. And that era is over. They cut, you know, they cut as much as they're going to cut, I think, as far as old growth anyway. So we have to be willing to fund it in other ways.
Well, so this often gets down to the kinds of things that Representative Greg Walden, who represents a lot of the area burning right now in Jackson and Josephine counties and everything east of the Cascades. I got one of his constituent letters recently at home, and when she talks about we need to get in there and do the kinds of fuel treatments you're talking about, but he also talks about salvaging burned timber, the big trees and stuff. I mean, what do you think about whether the big trees should stay or not? Do we have to make this economically viable for timber companies to be part of the process?
Yeah, I have been involved in several large salvage efforts, including the Biscuit. And as a general rule, the taxpayer winds up paying, I think, far too much of the bill for those. Those sales go deficit in most cases. In other words, the timber, because it's burned partly and for because it's an unplanned event, so they're basically going in a kind of emergency fashion and building roads real quick and stuff. Those sales just don't make money. And they wind up, so the taxpayer winds up footing the bill for reforestation and stuff. I do not believe salvage logging has anything to do with anything except keeping somebody who owns a sawmill happy.
So then that raises the question about the kind of fuel treatments you had talked about earlier. Should these be done by non-timber companies?
Yes, I think the vast majority of that work has to be done by nonprofits in the government and so forth, because, again, we've cut all the big timber near town. You know, we've taken all the easy money there. And even if they could get back in the woods and, you know, they got rid of a bunch of these environmental laws, they'd still run into all kinds of problems of economics because, again, the big stuff's gone.
And plus, they'd have to go farther out into the woods, assuming they could even reach big stuff, and then helicopters and road building and all that sort of stuff.
Right. If you got a really nice patch of timber, like we do have up in the mountains, way far away from the mills, but you got to build a road through 6 miles of serpentine or 6 miles of hardwood to get to that patch of really good conifer timber, you're not going to make a lot of money, and you're not going to have a bunch of money left over to do things like fuel treatment. No, we've got to bite the bullet and pay for fuel treatment, in my view.
Richard Fairbanks is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a fire expert, even has called in an expert witness in some fire cases, has many years of experience with the U.S. Forest Service, was the team leader for the Biscuit Fire Recovery Project after that fire burned 500,000 acres in 2002. Join the conversation on the Exchange. Lots of questions on the table, some of which you certainly want to ask, and some observations as well. Welcome at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Don and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, good morning, Jeff. And I've talked to you about this old idea of massive fire control or early fire control before using a fleet of tanker drones. And I've talked to a few other people about it. John Bailey up at Oregon State, he thought it was a good idea. If you could really control fire, then you could probably have better controlled burns, it sounds like a great idea. The controlled burn in Bandelier Forest down in New Mexico is a good example of one that got out of hand and destroyed a huge forest. But the tanker drone idea is that you have, you know, sky crane sized helicopters that are controlled by GPS, not by a pilot. And the fleet would be ready with retardant or whatever, and delivered in a you know, like a bucket brigade of giant helicopters, I guess. That's the best.
All right, so you're certainly not paying for pilots there, but you got some machinery costs up front for sure.
Well, sure. I mean, it's already, I think it's $10,000 a drop now for one of the tankers. But you also have the safety and the accuracy, and you can get closer. You're not affected by, you know, lack of vision. You have something that could really be massively, I mean, if we can destroy a city with a cruise missile, you should be able to get to a fire early before it geometrically expands.
Mm-hmm.
And that would not only give you the power to do controlled burns and this underbrush destruct, you know, destroying the fuel, but stopping it when you needed to.
All right, let's get
and
a response.
The thing that John pointed out is that you'd have to have speakers on the drones that was playing the Sorcerer's Apprentice. I think we went through that before.
Okay.
But,
all right.
All
right. Thanks for that, Don. Appreciate it. So Richard, what do you think about high-tech answers for firefighting and fuel treatment?
That's, I think, going to be part of the solution. I know for sure we could use better remote sensing. We could use drones, maybe not in that quite that role, but it's been very effective, the little bit of, pilot operations they've done, you know, just to test drones, for example. It's been very successful because they're unpiloted, so you don't have to worry about that human factor, and you're able to sort of spy on the fire in a way that hasn't been terribly efficient in the past. So sure, pilot project at the university. Maybe they could, test it on a small scale and see if it works.
We have an email here from Len in Selma. He says, I'm wondering if anyone has ever tested the chemical content of the trees and soils within the forests. Could it be that all the pollution from fossil fuel burning has turned the forests into fireworks? That again from Len in Selma.
Well, it's interesting. What we do know is there is a tremendous amount of additional cellulose fuel in the forest. I don't know if it's directly related to fossil fuels, maybe in the sense that the increased carbon dioxide is supposedly stimulating vegetation, that everything's growing a little faster because of the extra carbon. But I couldn't tie that all together for you.
We have another email here from Randy and Roosh, who says that Greg Walden, that's the member of Congress we just talked about, has proposed more industrial logging, which I assume would include clear cuts. It's my understanding that the resulting monospecies replants burn much hotter than other parts of the forest. We had a guest talk about that recently. Can you comment on that? From Randy and Roosh.
Yeah, he's got a point about plantation forestry. Blocks of young trees that are pretty much all the same size, same age, and have, when they are still young enough, to have limbs that go all the way to the ground and lots of little needles and things that are richly supplied with oxygen during combustion. Yes, they can burn just like a brush field, very similar. Short-statured vegetation all in one block like that can be a pretty hot day.
So when we talk about fuel treatments again and the idea of restoring fire to the landscape, if there is as much fuel out there as we all seem to agree on, you're going to have to do extensive treatments, it sounds like. Basically, something along the lines of the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project writ on a very grand scale.
Yes, it would be something along those lines. And one of the things that we would do is, because spring and fall and even winter is such a good time to get treatment done without exposing the public to a lot of smoke and without exposing the worker to the dangers of a wildfire. The controlled burning can be very effective, and because you extend the season, your seasonal workforce, rather than having people come in from Arizona and everywhere else to fight a wildfire, you can have a year-round workforce doing that work. And people say, well, how are you going to pay for it? Well, we spent $180 million putting out the Biscuit Fire, for example. If we had spent that same $180 million on controlled burning and roadside thinning and mechanical treatment and, all those solutions, I think in the long run it would be cheaper.
Richard Fairbanks, I read an opinion piece you wrote offering solutions after last fire season, and one of the things was about the fire borrowing. You at least mollified somewhat that Congress seems to be ending that practice and is at least funding firefighting?
Yes, I'm thrilled that they are doing that. I'm really sorry that you have to call it a disaster to get any money, because a lot of those fires aren't disasters. They're just, out somewhere away from houses and people and just doing their thing. But at least we got that fire borrowing thing. We seem to have corralled that. So yes, I'm very happy about that piece of legislation.
But from what you were just saying in the previous discussion, the idea that we need to have firefighters on hand for the summer, it sounds like it's becoming an archaic way of looking at things, and particularly in California, where it's really not a fire season so much as a fire year. You're talking about if you have people on the payroll all year long and they're doing the burning in the woods, they don't have to work as hard in the summer.
Well, that's exactly the idea. Do you burn a block in the winter or in the fall and spring? Again, when the air is unstable, you're also getting working conditions that are a lot better for the firefighters, and they can get a lot more acres done. So I think it's really an all-around good deal.
So that opinion piece I referenced that you wrote about last year's fire season, other than changing the funding mechanism for forest firefighting in the federal budget, has anybody used any of your ideas?
Well, you know, I think they're all getting, by the way, all of that stuff I get from the scientific literature or from my colleagues that are either still fighting fire or are like me, they're retired fire people. I think a lot of the stuff is things people would like to try, things that are being tried. You mentioned the Klamath. That's just a hotbed of innovation with respect to fire down there in the Karuk country. So there's all kinds of interesting things going on. I think we just got a couple of years ago, California passed a statewide building code, and I believe that each county has to adopt that. But it's a statewide model code that makes just a few modifications, not terribly expensive or anything like that, that makes homes a lot less flammable.
Right, which is one of the major issues, as you pointed out, with the fire NATO in Redding. And you're talking about each home with 8,000 to 10,000 board feet of lumber. Is that what you said?
Exactly. The making the homes less flammable would be a tremendous boon to both firefighters and to the budget, ultimately. Because we, the taxpayer, ultimately pay for when construction is done in a way that doesn't pay attention to the possibility of a wildfire.
All right. Rich Fairbanks, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Good to talk to you.
Okay, thank you.